Good evening, everyone. The Four Noble Truths have been the theme of the evening talks, and so far we have covered basically the first three of the Four Noble Truths. As you may remember, the first Noble Truth being dukkha, the second being the causes of dukkha, craving and ignorance, the third one being the end of dukkha, or the realization of nirvana. And today we should spend some time talking about the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, which is called the Eightfold Noble Path. So the Eightfold Noble Path is the fourth Noble Truth, and namely that is the path leading to the end of dukkha. Now I've started to introduce the word dukkha to the English dictionary. Why not? Buddha is there, and dharma is there, karma is there. Why not dukkha? So since we have been talking extensively about the various shades of meaning of dukkha, by now you probably got the picture what dukkha means. And in your own sitting experience, you may have experienced some of that dukkha also. The dukkha part of it, just sitting is dukkha sometimes. But then, the path leading to the end of dukkha, being the Eightfold Noble Path, can be sometimes divided into three for convenience sake, and then it is called sila, samadhi, panya, or ethics, mental development, and wisdom. And when you want to hear all the eight limbs of the Eightfold Noble Path, then it comes from right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So the first two of those eight limbs are considered to be panya or wisdom, whereas if we say sila, samadhi, panya, panya comes at the end, but in the Eightfold Noble Path, in the enumeration of the factors, it comes at the beginning, and we can talk a little bit about why that may be. And then the ethical part, the sila, with the right, you know, speech, right action, right livelihood, comes as a second. And then the right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration under the samadhi, or, well, development of mind or meditation limb or step. So you could say it is a three-step path to liberation of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. Now sometimes wisdom is seen as the result of the practice, that you come to wisdom through the practice of ethical behavior and then meditation. But why should it be put at the very beginning of the Eightfold Noble Path in the enumeration in the texts? Well, perhaps we could say there is a kind of, a worldly right view and right thought, and as a result of meditation, the higher understanding of wisdom could be that is coming through realization, the wisdom which comes from meditation. So the worldly right view, in a sense, would be, for instance, to know beforehand, before you have realized it for yourself, that all conditioned things are impermanent. For instance, you could say that would be the right view. If you think about it, you can figure it out as well. And then what is impermanent can never be 100% satisfactory. Even the happiest, loftiest moments, if they are not permanent, then they must be sort of unsatisfactory, because they can turn into their opposite. So that is kind of cerebral or intellectual understanding of the wisdom, but it is not yet the realized wisdom, so therefore it could come as a kind of base, but also seen as a result after the realization through meditation. So even that Eightfold Noble Path is not something like the path from Washington, D.C. to New York City or something like that, like a trail from A to B, although you could say, well, it is from suffering to the end of suffering, but it is not a kind of physical location where you go from one place to another, but more something that happens inside of you. So therefore, even the Fourth Noble Truth has to be trodden by oneself. It's not to be done by anybody else. So the emphasis in Buddhist teachings is very much on a sort of do-it-yourself course, and not to rely on external agencies, although we do like to receive blessings of the invisible helpers whenever possible, but they cannot really solve our problems for us, and especially that of dukkha and the cause of dukkha, we have to really work on that ourselves. So, doing the Eightfold Noble Path means also to put some kind of order into one's life, into one's, speech, and into one's actions also. Now, sometimes, you know, young people don't like that sort of ethical teaching, this preaching of ethics and morality, and they would like to rather skip it. But sometimes, you know, if there's no morality, for instance, if one keeps on killing life and stealing and sexual misconduct and lying and things like that, then it would be very difficult to collect your mind and become very calm and peaceful, because all these sins would then come up probably, unless you're a really professional one, but you know, come to your mind and your conscience and bother you and prevent you from getting into the concentration and the peaceful state of mind. Probably you would then be caught up with your own actions and be confronted with it in a bad way. So therefore, the putting order into one's life and doing the good things rather than the bad things, or rather the skillful things than the unskillful things, you know, the unskillful things being based on greed, hatred, delusion, so that always involves some kind of suffering for oneself or others. If you cause it to others, it comes back to you. And the skillful things, that which leads to peace and happiness and prosperity, well-being of others as well as yourself. So those kind of actions could be a guideline. And did I already mention to you about the advice that the Buddha gave to his own son, Rahula? Maybe not. Huh? Because I've been giving a number of talks before this, so I thought, is it here or there, or where was it? But the advice that the Buddha gave to his own son, Rahula, maybe some of you didn't know that he had a son, he left his wife and child just after his birth, the first son, to go on his search for truth and for these 6 years of austerities, meditation, fasting, until he got enlightened. And after giving the first sermon or discourse to his friends, those ascetics in Banaras, in the deer park, he had gone to Kapilavastu, the palace where he grew up, and met his wife and son, And by that time the son was 7 years old, and he gave some advice which is called Rahulovada Sutta, the discourse on the advice of Rahula or to Rahula. And he said, "Son, just before you say something or before you do something, briefly consider whether this is going to be helpful or harmful to the other and or yourself. If it's going to be harmful to the other and yourself, don't do it, don't say it. If it's going to be harmful to the other and only good for yourself, refrain from saying that or doing that, because it's going to hurt the other party. And if it's going to be helpful to both the other and yourself, definitely say it and do it. And if it's going to be helpful to the other but a little bit difficult for yourself, you can still consider doing it or saying it because of a kind of helpfulness to the other person." So these are the kind of four combinations that one can choose from, and to explain it in words takes about a minute or two, but if you consider it in your own mind, you could take a deep breath, for instance, before you say something or before you do something, and realize what is the probable outcome of your words and deeds, and then refrain from it if it's going to be hurting the other person. So you can avoid those situations where you have to say, "I didn't really mean to say this, I didn't really mean to do this," and that could avoid a lot of bad effects in one's life if one just realizes. Basically, it's also on that principle of don't do to others what you don't want to be done to yourself, like in the commandments sort of thing. So, but it puts really the responsibility also on yourself, whether to say this or not. Sometimes we don't know what's good or bad, but this is a very good guideline, even for children to understand, and for adults as well. Of course, what's good and bad and what is skillful, what is unskillful, sometimes becomes more and more complicated the more we grow up and the more complicated the society becomes and so on. But still, I think this is a very good guideline to go by. And that helps us to observe basically the precepts also. The 5 precepts, the 8 precepts, the 10 precepts, the 227 precepts. You know, the monks are supposed to observe 227 precepts. But they go into minor details where, you know, sometimes you wonder, oh, yes. There was a story of a small monk, you know, who was getting ready for his higher ordination at the age of 20, and he didn't have a very good memory. He couldn't by heart all these 227 precepts. So actually he became despondent, and he thought, "I can't remember all these things, let me disrobe and go home." This was during the time of the Buddha, and he had another teacher, and the teacher said, "Let's go and find some advice from the Buddha himself." So the Buddha said, "Could you remember just 3 things?" And he said, "Ah, yes, I think I can do that." "Well, what are those 3 things?" "Well, can you remember to be aware of what you're doing with your body?" "Ah, yes, I can remember that." "And then number 2, can you remember to be aware of what you're doing with your speech?" "Yes, I can do that too." "And can you remember to be aware of your thoughts?" "Well, I can try," he said. And this little monk went back and practiced this to the letter, and apparently became an arahat, a liberated being, which goes to show that rather by hearting 227 rules, just remembering these 3 things sort of covered everything, and he actually attained highest possible development, not by hearting things, but by practicing. So it's something similar to that also with the panya or prajna, the wisdom. is not an accumulation of a lot of texts and a lot of knowledge and a lot of facts, but rather practicing something, maybe even one or two or three of the instructions of the Buddha, and doing it well and realizing it for oneself, and that then becomes wisdom that nobody can take away from you, that is your own. Whereas borrowed knowledge and borrowed wisdom would be second hand and not really changing fundamentally your behavior or your mind, not uprooting what you call the causes of suffering, or uprooting greed, hatred and delusion. So that wisdom part, as I mentioned before, can come in three stages. One is the type which is called wisdom which arises from hearing. And there was this instance of the Buddha giving his speech to those first five ascetics, and one of them realized the exact meaning and the implications of the saying, "Sabbe sankhara anicca," all conditioned things are impermanent. And suddenly his mind became freed from clinging, from attachment, from delusion, and he became an arhat on the spot, so to speak. And his name was Kondanya, and Buddha uttered, "Anya Kondanya," he has understood. So, since we are not all Anya Kondanyas, and most people need a little bit more explanation, you know, in most cases when it comes to hearing the Dharma, it goes in, I'm not saying in your case, huh, but it goes in one ear and sort of out the other. Maybe 90% of it goes out and about 5% remains. But never mind, if you really are listening and understand, and it's being recorded, you can get us. So that is the disadvantage of just listening to Dharma, that a lot of it gets really forgotten. But then there is this second way of getting wisdom, is by thinking about it and discussing it and also investigating it within yourself. That is a kind of activity. They say to listen to the Dharma from time to time is a great blessing, and then it says to discuss the Dharma from time to time is a great blessing. Discussing it sometimes can make it more clear. And although, you know, sometimes if it's the blind leading the blind, then it can be more leading to confusionism rather than clarity. But still, if you are able to look at the things that is being talked about in the Buddha's teachings and you investigate it in yourself, for instance, feelings are impermanent. You can investigate that in yourself. Thoughts are impermanent or unsatisfactory, and things like that. Non-self also can be realized, and even thought can lead to a conclusion that, yes, it sounds right, it's not against reason, and yeah, probably it's right. You can give it almost like the benefit of the doubt and then come to a kind of understanding, which is called intellectual understanding. And that, of course, is still a shortcoming of the real realization, and therefore it doesn't always lead to the real wisdom, unless it is a kind of an aha experience through analysis or something like that. So the third form of wisdom comes actually through the self-realization by introspection or meditation, and that is what we are trying to do, is the insight into the reality within oneself. And if one finds those things as they really are, the characteristics of existence, and then could infer that if it is like this within me, it's probably the same in other beings, although we don't know exactly what's going on in the, let's say, the butterfly's mind or something like that, you know. But at least we can think that in human beings this would be the case. And, well, that kind of realization which comes from direct experience by deep insight with a sprinkling of samatha or tranquility as well. You know, if you have a very scattered mind, then insight may not arise very easily. There has to be a certain base of certain amount of tranquility also. And I don't know whether you got some tranquility already during this retreat, I suppose so. Today, for instance, during the sweeping the body meditation, there was a beautiful tranquility I found, tangible tranquility. And I don't know whether that was true for everybody, but I could feel something special. Anyway, that the tranquility is not really the final goal of the meditation, but the insight, wisdom, and then leading to liberation, the liberation from ignorance, greed and craving and so on. So that is to be realized through these steps of sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, mental culture or meditation, and leading to wisdom. And liberation from that dukkha, basically, the liberation from being born again and again and again, that would be considered to be the highest bliss. And one could wonder, in a way, isn't that a negative Weltanschauung, if you call it, you know, like looking at the world in a negative way? To get out of this is the highest bliss. Well, if it is only like that, it may be seen. Isn't there something beautiful in this world, in the nature? Of course there is. And in human beings and the music and the literature, the philosophy of the world, there is real beauty in that. And of course, that is also true. And we don't want to sort of deny that and stop everything and, you know, that may be the wrong impression of what we say is getting out of this samsara. But the process of becoming, that craving and that wanting to become something different and never satisfied with what you have or what you are, that kind of process, the bhava, nirodha, nibbana, that when the bhava comes to an end, then there is nirvana, which doesn't mean that you leave the world or you are, you know, dying and not reborn. That may come at the very end of the life, but as the Buddha's example itself shows, that he attained that lofty state at the age of 35. He did not die, he became even more alive, but his motivation of being alive was not just selfishness after that enlightenment, it was just selflessness and compassion. Based on his insight, wisdom and compassion, he went all over the place and helped tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people during his lifetime. And he was considered one of the greatest historical personages in the world also, and his enlightenment was a kind of maybe a step in the evolution of mankind also. And referring that to what we were talking the other day about Rupert Sheldrake's, you know, what was it called, morphogenetic resonance and field, that something happened in the consciousness of mankind with the enlightenment of the Buddha, could very well be. So this is more or less, I think, what I could say about the Eightfold Noble Path being the fourth of the Noble Truths, and that it is to be practiced by oneself, not by another. There's another saying, you know, in the Buddha's teachings, be a light to yourself, be an island to yourself and be a light to yourself. That word island and light, dīpa, is the same word in Pali, and scholars sometimes debate about it. What did he really mean? Be an island to yourself, be a light to yourself. But in both cases, it is to be independent from others in a way. So not isolated like on an island, but not depending on others and outer circumstances for your real happiness. And of course, the worldly happiness comes and goes. That is natural. Even Buddha could not avoid those kind of circumstances where he was sometimes blamed. Unnecessarily, of course, but he was blamed. And there was a threat to his life also by his sort of cousin, I think. Devadatta was a cousin of the Buddha. And always it seems that Devadatta and the Buddha in various lives had been born in the same family circle, and always Devadatta was a kind of, a person who was jealous of him, and he was also against him, and he was even trying to kill the Buddha at one stage by rolling a rock down from the top of a hill where the Buddha was seated or walking just below. But it is said it bounced and only a sliver of that rock hit the heel of the Buddha and it did not kill him. But that happened at a place called Rajgir in the state of Bihar in India, just north of Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha had his enlightenment. And things like that, there were circumstances of heat and cold and hunger and thirst. Not that the Buddha really went hungry, because he had a very good support system, you could say. Kings and bankers and business people supported him and built monasteries, and some people gave mango groves to reside in, and they had fairly good infrastructure, you could say. But it was not luxurious, but it was sufficient. And I don't think the Buddha really went hungry in that way. But the circumstances in India, if you look at how cold it gets in the winter and how hot it gets in the summer, were some of the things that even the Buddha could not avoid. But he did not cringe, or he did not sort of mentally suffer because of that. Also not because of insults and so on. But that is also something that we may be dealing with now a little bit, what they call the eight worldly dharmas, they call it, or the eight worldly conditions. That is, I can always only remember six of the eight, but never mind. It is gain and loss, happiness and unhappiness, and fame and blame, and another pair of opposite, which is very similar to that. And those are things that people go through. You know, there's happiness and unhappiness in everybody's life, and there's sometimes gain, sometimes loss. Now, people who play on the stock market, of course, you know, their happiness goes down when the stock market goes down, or their blood pressure goes up when the index goes down, and the other way around. They're very much influenced, moody, by those fluctuations. And when people get blamed, they don't like it. When they get fame or when they get praised, yeah, it's praise and blame and things like that. It's pleasant and unpleasant. But the Buddha said you should try to develop some equanimity towards these eight worldly conditions. Like the other day we were talking about to be or not to be, and whether it's nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, that means the ups and downs and the vicissitudes of life, whether it is braver to get out of it or to face them, so one could say, to face them with equanimity would be a very good way of living. And if you understand that these circumstances are just conditioned and not eternal and not really you or yourself or, you know, your real self, but just under the circumstances, then perhaps we can gain equanimity and a bit of distance towards those circumstances, not be what is called, you know, heavenly, happy with gain, and you know, depressed very much by the loss and things like that. So to gain equanimity, there is a funny story. Sorry about my funny stories, but you know, about two Zen masters, Chan masters in China, who one was a monk living on a little island, and the other one was a lay teacher living on the side of the lake where that other monk had his hermitage in the island. And the one living on the island had the idea that he had attained very lofty states of development, and he wrote a little verse, you know, in Chinese characters on a little scroll, like a calligraphy, where it says, even the eight winds cannot, the eight great winds cannot shake me, like these eight worldly conditions cannot shake me. So, 这个八个大风不会经常乒乓, something like that. My Mandarin is not up to the mark yet. So he rolled it up and sent it across to the other Zen master. And when the other Zen master read it, he just went like, P. And P means, well, I'll just spell it for you, F-A-R-T. That is the little wind which usually exudes from the behind. So he just wrote one letter back to him, P. And then he sent it back to him. And when he read this, he blew up and he lost his cool. And then the other Zen master said, well, if a small wind like this shakes you that much, what about the eight great winds, you see? Well, yeah. So there you have to be careful how far we have actually progressed in our, you know, spiritual life or not. It's in the term test, in a way, that in real life that it comes. And there's another story of Achan Sumedho, for instance, you know, of the Thai forest tradition, who was under Achan Cha for many years, and then he also thought that he had attained quite good states of mind and progress in his meditation. But when he was still living in Thailand and he had to go for his yearly visa extension, and they didn't give him an extension, he also lost it, you know. And then he realized, oh, I'm not as far as I thought. So it is like when we are practicing in a retreat like this, then sometimes we get very lofty states and very good tranquility and beautiful mind. But when we have to face the reality sometimes, that's where the term test comes from. And one thing is that in our meditation, if you do it regularly, you may not notice the progress that you make so much, you know. Maybe when you start meditation and in the first couple of days or weeks you think, oh, it's going up like this, and then slowly the curve will level out and it will take sort of nitty-gritty practice, and then the progress cannot be measured so much. But sometimes, after some time, you can notice that you may be reacting differently to a same sort of situation than before. Similar situation as before doesn't affect you that much as it did some time ago. And there are these utterances of joy by the Buddha's disciples, monks and nuns who have written poetry. They're called the Theragata and the Therigata. Theras are the elder, the monks, and the Theris are the elder nuns, and they have already attained this arahathood state, and they would say things like, when I was young, I used to have a lot of greed and jealousy and lust and hatred, but now I'm free from it. And then something like, hooray, I'm free from it. So they would utter this in more poetic language than I just did, but you know, it was a sign of them having attained that real liberation. And then, of course, not everybody, well, needs to go that far. There are some people who say, I actually like it, this samsara. I'd like to not get out of it. What's wrong with samsara? There's also something to be said for that. But maybe later on it turns out that it's not 100% satisfactory. And but then if you say, well, I can face all the ups and downs of existence, not like that monk who thought he could, but you can really have equanimity towards all the worldly things. You're not really getting attached. You love beings, but you're not being hurt when there's no reciprocity or things like that. Maybe you can live like that quite peacefully and happily. But still, well, you know, I don't want to sound dogmatic, but really speaking, unless and until we have really uprooted the greed and the hatred and delusion, this game just keeps on going on and on and on and on, in different forms, in different levels. And if you like it, then maybe you should stay in it, but when you say enough is enough, then you should start working on how to overcome this. So, and we think that that is through this insight meditation is the best way. The Buddha said in his sort of preamble to the Satipatthana Sutta, the beginning of it, that this is the way to overcome suffering, to purify the mind, and to reach the highest goal. So it is a kind of overcoming of dukkha, through the purification also of the mind, and then the highest goal of the realization of the nirvana. So that sentence has been also translated as the one and only way sometimes. Sometimes it is one way, ekayano maggo, it is in Pali, but scholars also seem to have differed in their translations. Is it the one and only way, or the one way, or one way? It's quite different sort of shades of meaning, of course. That shows there may be other means as well. But still, we believe, as Theravada Buddhists, that this is the way to overcome suffering and to purify oneself and to reach the highest goal. So, that is about it, I think, what I could say, not only about the fourth noble truth, but also about these eight worldly conditions. And do you have anything spontaneously? I know to some people observing the silence is kept rather strictly, and they find it very funny when they hear their own voice after so many days. But if you have, yes, please. Right livelihood, okay. Yes, that is one of the limbs of the Eightfold Noble Path. And there, the Buddha has said things like, to earn your livelihood not by deceiving people or by selling weapons or poison or by gambling, for instance, but by something that is not harmful to others especially and to yourself as well. And they call that a dharmic kind of way of earning your living. So it doesn't necessarily have to be by the sweat on your forehead. Nowadays you have these high-tech jobs which don't, in air-conditioned environment, which, you know, you don't need to sweat, but still you put in quite a lot of effort and knowledge and skills, and then you earn your money in a righteous way. So that doesn't harm anybody else, really. There are, you know, there's an organization called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, FWBO, that was founded by a Britisher called Sangharakshita. He spent 14 years in Kalimpong in the eastern Himalayas near Darjeeling, Sikkim and Bhutan, that area. He got ordained in 1948 already, it's quite long ago, and he's now very old and he is almost blind, but the British Sangha Council invited him back to India, to England, and he was first in charge of one vihara in Hampstead, London, and later on, when they went pindapata or walking for alms rounds, even barefoot in October, November in the heaths of Hampstead Heath, somebody saw him walking. And he said, "What are you doing?" "Well, we are on our alms round," but there was nobody who understood that they were, you know, supposed to put something into the alms bowl to eat. But they just did it as a practice. And then one day, a jogger who had been going on that path every day, I'm talking now about a story that has to do with Sumedho. And I was talking about Sangharakshita. Sangharakshita came back to England, but he lived in the vihara where Sumedho also lived for some time. And then the man, the jogger, said, "I have something, but it doesn't fit into your bowl. It's about 100 acres of land and an old house I would like to offer." And he offered his old house and land to the Sangha. But that was not to Sangharakshita, that was to Sumedho. And Sangharakshita founded what's called the FWBO, the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And why am I telling all this? They have what is called right livelihood communities for their members. They don't have an ordained sangha with robes like this. They wear, at times when they're in function, only a kind of a insignia or something like that. But they're called sangha members. They're called ordained, but I don't think they call it Sangha. And the other members, what they're called, friends, mitras of that organization, they sometimes live in communities, and they have what is called right livelihood communities, like they may run a vegetarian restaurant and a bookshop with books on Buddhism and philosophy and culture, or they do jobs like landscaping and things like that, and or social services, all kinds of things which are not harmful to anybody and quite good in the vein of Buddha's teachings in a way. And that organization actually grew, and it is now on all the 5 continents and have about 350 centers around the world. FWBO.org will take you there. And that the founder, he was also a very good author, a very good intellectual and a scholar. Like, he already wrote Survey of Buddhism, a thick book, when he was 29 years old, while he was still living in Kalimpong, and numbers of books after that. Quite interesting. What he was trying to do was to make Buddhism more understandable in the West and more livable in the West, because sometimes Buddhism is sort of identified with like Eastern culture, and the cultural part sometimes takes over and the practical part of living Buddhism in the West gets second place. But there they were trying to integrate it into Western society.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.